Joining us now, he's the former president of the PGA of America. He's an author. He's a favorite of the show. Ted Bishop joins us. Ted, welcome back.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure to be with you.
Man, it's great to talk to you. I've got something here. I was arguing earlier today with somebody on Facebook about the state of golf. And this guy's post was, how irrelevant has the PGA become? Some dude named Xander Schauffele won the PGA Tour Championship. Seriously. And I went on to argue with him, like, look, you know what? There's 35 different winners on the PGA Tour. I think the state of the game is great, despite the fact that we don't have Tiger, Ernie Els, Phil Mickelson winning events. What do you think?
Well, I don't know how anybody could not agree with you that the state of the game at the tour level is more than great. I mean, you've got a whole host of young players, and I think you've got some budding rivalries that are on the horizon, and it's going to be great for the fans and great for the sport.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my point is that coming into this year, you know, you talk about people want to see, you know, there was always the Tiger effect. People wanted to see either Tiger win or Tiger not win. You were either on one side or the other, you know, and they talk about guys winning tournaments. And it seems like if guys don't win a lot of tournaments, then people aren't interested in watching them play golf. But, you know, coming into this season, if Justin Thomas was leading the tournament, was he pushing the needle? Probably not. But is Justin Thomas pushing the needle now? Certainly. So do we need to give these guys a chance to maybe show that they can be not in the next Tiger Woods, but somebody who wins a lot of golf tournaments and pushes the needle?
Well, yeah, exactly. But I think the other thing you've got going here is I know Spieth and Thomas are friends. And I know them both. I know Thomas better than I know Spieth. But these guys are both competitors. And, you know, Jordan has had the best of Justin up until this year. And I guess still you could say that when you compare their records in major championships that he's got the best of him. But I think you got a hell of a rivalry brewing here. And you got two guys that like to win. And it's going to be fun to see how all this plays out, even though they're good friends.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're doing is recentering how we view a rivalry. And again, I think the Tiger thing needs to be put in a time capsule someplace and put away. I like that these guys like each other and still want to step on each other's necks. And I think there are a lot of those combinations that we could see emerge over the next couple of years. I mean, there are other rivalries that we want to see Jason and Rory, and we want to see Dustin, and we want to see these guys go after each other. But it's okay that they don't hate each other personally. In fact, I think it fuels it a little bit because, you know, most of us are out there competing on a basketball court or a tennis court or on a golf course with our buddies, and we want to stuff their faces in it too. And I think we can relate more to friendly rivalries than we can sort of the cold-natured, you know, steely glance and the intimidation of Tiger Woods.
Well, I think that's a great point. That's a great example and a good way to put it. But I think the other thing you're seeing, and you know, when you talk about Woods, you're always going to talk about 14 majors. Talk about Jack, you're going to talk about 18. And you know, it'll be really interesting to see how this whole thing unfolds in 10, 15, 20 years. But I think you could make a case that you could pick those four or five guys right now that you just mentioned, and you could add up all their majors, and at the end of the day, they may not equal 14 or 18 combined.
Yeah.
But it gets back to the point you were making originally about the state of the game and the depth that you're seeing right now in the PGA Tour.
Yeah, and I'm curious. You know, we're talking about Justin Thomas, and you mentioned knowing him fairly well. You know, statistically, last year, and this was an answer from earlier in the show, I mean, he was middling most of the year, and then he went from 72nd in shots gained to fifth, and from 53rd in shots gained tee to green to sixth. What does a guy do between one season and the next, especially with this wraparound crap around? It never seems to end, so there's not much of an off season. But what does a guy like Justin Thomas do to make such gains statistically? Is it just confidence, or are there things that he was doing in the off season to improve his game?
Well, you know, I know his dad, Mike, who's a PGA professional at Harmony Landing in Louisville. I know Mike. I served on the PGA Board of Directors with him better than I know Justin, but I've talked to Mike a little bit about what he's done with Justin as it relates to the relationship between teacher and student, even though it's also father and son. And, you know, Mike is what I've called kind of a hands-off teacher, and I think he was a guy that did a really good job with his son at a young age in terms of fundamentals. And over the years, he's just kind of tweaking a little bit and make sure that probably the basic things like grip, aim, setup, which are important to everybody, were the things that, that he was dialed in on. And I think that Justin's success this year, maybe a combination of two things, certainly gaining confidence and winning breeds confidence. But I also think that, you know, he's now had a full year of Jimmy Johnson on the bag, and I don't think you can underestimate the value of having an experienced caddy who was with him, some of the pressure-packed points that he was in. And, boy, you go back to the U.S. Open, and you know, what if that would have wound up a little bit differently for Justin, and what kind of year would he have had if he would have won two majors? And that certainly was within his grasp.
Yeah, definitely. You know, as far as the state of the game for us mere mortals, what do you see out at your place? I mean, what's going on in terms of rounds played? I mean, are you seeing a consistent gain, and more people coming out to play, or people maybe playing nine holes more? What are you seeing?
Well, a couple things that I would throw out there for you. We put a millennial rate in this year, and if there was one thing that I was seeing at a public golf course that kind of disturbed me, was a lack of some of the younger players at my facility. I'm a medium-priced facility just south of Indianapolis, and I just wasn't seeing the young guys or girls, for that matter. A lot of seniors during the week, and so we put a millennial rate in on the weekends, and that turned out to be huge for us. We've created close to 400 new customers in our database, and these are all people that are 35 years of age or younger. And that's been a great revenue source, probably going to be, I'd say close to a $60,000 revenue source for us at the end of the year when you take into consideration green fees, cards, and residual dollars that were spent. So that's good. And I think that I'm kind of changed my attitude, and I'm a little bit more positive maybe on the future of golf, seeing that, you know, we now have these players, you know, playing. And the key, though, was the rate structure. And, you know, I talked to some of these younger players in the spring when they came out, and I said, what's your ceiling? I mean, what's your cap? What can you afford to pay if you got to dig into the wallet, do it each time? And it was a $25 to $30 rate. And I think if you research millennials and you look at some of the obstacles that they have to hurdle, a lot of them are facing the payoff of college student loan debt. Their work schedules are kind of crazy. And a lot of them are still maybe not employed full-time in the job market. So price was a huge thing. At the same time, these millennials that I attracted were what I would call core golfers. They were people that had been instructed by their fathers, their grandfathers, or, you know, somewhere along those lines. And they know how to play the game. They enjoy the game. Doesn't necessarily mean they're good players, but they play fast and they get around there. The other thing that I would say that I think is a real problem in the game, we just got done hosting one of five high school golf regionals in the state of Indiana on Saturday, and I had 108 girls in the field, and the pace of play for 18 holes was 6 hours and 45 minutes.
Ugh.
And it was a death march. And, it kind of turned the light on with me. I've hosted a lot of junior events over the years, but I see an increasing problem with pace of play with juniors today, whether it's boys or girls, either one. The time they take on the green, the amount of practice swings and the pre-shot routines that they go through. And I think PGA pros, myself included, and state golf associations have got a major obligation to really develop what I would call pace of play curriculum that is just as important as all the swing thoughts that we're trying to give kids to keep them engaged and make them better players. As the PGA of America, I don't want this to sound like sour grapes, but they're doing absolutely nothing on this front. There's nothing with the PGA Junior League program that really emphasizes pace of play. I mean, the USGA certainly has tried some pace of play initiatives lately, but think about it. I can't remember any that have been directed right at kids, and that needs to happen because it's ultimately it's going to be a big deterrent to keep those kids interested in the game and become future players.
Well, yeah, I mean, it seems like a fairly simple thing to deal with. I mean, you've hit on something with the rate structure for young players, for young professionals, new college graduates or whatever, and you've hit on something with pace of play. A lot of these programs that we've seen come and go, whether it's the forward tees or it's, you know, getting people to play nine or what have you, they don't seem to address the core problems. And I think getting the rate structure under control for young people to get out and play, and nobody has 6 hours. I mean, the biggest complaint among young family members is that you can't even get your kid to go out and do it with you for 5.5 hours, let alone, you know, become a lifelong golfer. So if you could wave the magic wand, are those the two things that you would change in golf in this country, pace of play and rate structure?
Well, I think, you know, the rate structure is relative as it relates to what kind of an operation you run and where you're located. But I think we all know as golfers progress and migrate over the years, I think virtually, well, I'm going to say a very high percentage start out at a public golf course somewhere, unless they're fortunate enough to be sons and daughters of parents who are members of private clubs. And, you know, as the years go by and their incomes increase and their desire for social activities may increase, then ultimately they may wind up joining a private club. But their entry level into golf, as it is the case with most people, is at public golf courses. And if you look at one thing that's really important at public golf courses, it's getting people around the golf course in a timely fashion. And we've talked a lot about pace of play with adults. And I've been in this business for 41 years. And I never really thought much about it until the last couple of days. I mean, we've tried to implement some things at our PGA Junior League level locally about, you know, how to walk to your ball, walk with, you know, some authority, and how to carry your bag, get there fast, and, you know, be ready. I think one of the rules changes, obviously, next year that probably will go into effect is ready golf, and I think that'll benefit the sport. But there needs to be a concentrated effort on teaching kids how to go out and play 9 holes in 2 hours.
Well, we're talking to our good friend Ted Bishop, former president of the PGA of America. And Ted, before we let you go, you know, we're addressing the playability, the competitive side of it. What about the fan experience for the PGA Tour? I mean, I'm not a big fan of the wraparound or crap-around season because I think it just doesn't give us a chance to miss the sport. What can we be doing to bring more fans to the professional game?
Well, you know, I think I was not a big fan of the PGA Championship moving to May, and I'm still not. And, I mean, that's a discussion for a whole other segment because I think of the limitations that it puts on the championship in terms of where it can be played and what it's going to look like in 15 or 20 years. That being said, I think what that move did for the overall golf schedule was a very positive thing. I haven't seen the TV ratings from yesterday, but I can tell you this. In my golf shop, the football games were on yesterday afternoon and not the finals of the FedEx Cup until late in the day. So I think getting the FedEx completed before the start of football season is a good thing. And I think, to your point, at least now, other than the President's Cup and the Ryder Cup, you probably are going to have some time off anyway before the start of the fall wraparound season. I tend to agree with you. I think there's too many events. I think it waters down the season. I mean, I understand why the tour's doing it. They got plenty of money. They're trying to give guys a lot of playing opportunities. And to their credit, they've been able to maintain sponsorship relationships and really grow the playing opportunities for their players. And that's kind of the mission statement of the PGA Tour. And I think you know, as somebody in the golf media, I've got to kind of take a step back and think about that because, I mean, that's really kind of what they're doing. They're working for their players, and they're creating earning opportunities for their clientele, and that's their job. But I agree with you. I think that it's probably diminished to a degree the overall interest by fans in the sport. I mean, I think TV ratings continue to decline again this year, and I just think there's a lot of golf.
Yeah, it just comes down to sheer competition, and the more that you can separate yourself out from major sporting events, the better off you're going to be.
Well, I think the other thing, you know, one of the greatest interviews I ever saw Arnold Palmer give was at Bay Hill one year, and he talked about what his obligation was as a player when he was playing on the tour. And he said, you know, it was impossible for me to play in every single tour event each year. But he said, I tried to set my schedule up where at least once every 3 or 4 years, I could make an appearance at every PGA Tour event that was being played. He said, I knew what my obligation was to those sponsors, and I tried to make it a point to do that. And, you know, today with the major championships, with the Players Championship, with the World Golf Championships, you know, you're looking right there at basically 10 events. And, you know, most of these guys, given the amount of money they're making, are only playing in 15 to 18 events. Mm-hmm. And that's the other problem right. when you look at the quality of the fields that many of the normal tour stops.
Yeah. All right. Well, Ted, man, we always appreciate you talking to us, and we love your opinions, and I'm with you. I didn't like moving the PGA Championship to May, but we'll deal with it as it is. So, again, we appreciate it as always, my man.
Hey, thanks. Great talking to you.